In America, we all know if you violate the copyright law, somebody sends you a cease and desist and you choose to discredit, you're going to get sued and you're going to court. And if the federal judge grants them statutory damages, whatever it is, you got to pay. If they don't, there's a default judgment. Then they can start taking assets. All right, you see, there's a whole process I just walked through here. You see how we all laugh? It's like somebody violates. It's a, well, yeah, let them listen to the music. And it's like, there's no consequence.
Amy Orefo. She's the lawyer behind some of the biggest names in music, media, and entertainment. Amy isn't just reading contracts. She is rewriting the rules.
Understand the basic foundation of how money is made in the industry. It's all an artist needs to do. Your team does not need to learn that for you. You need to read a book, sit in a studio, ask, pick the brains of mentors, and know that part. Then have your team to help you enforce it around you. But your average artist is not willing to learn that.
From Atlanta to Lagos, she's helping creatives protect their power, scale their brands, and build businesses that last.
As a Black woman, being an entertainment attorney, I get the passive aggressive. It's sort of like, hey, how did you start working with them? Do you ask my white counterpart that? Because I work with a whole bunch of Black men. What are you saying? Then when you turn it back on, how do you start working with your clients? They're quiet. I know what you're doing. That's the kind of stuff we have to deal with as women. I believed in them before you would. That's why they're here, because they know a Black woman will hold them down. Any other questions?
On this episode of Afropolitan, we talk ownership, mentorship, and what every artist needs to know before they sign anything.
You have managed multi-million dollar negotiations, yeah, right? Yeah. And so I want you to walk through what was the most difficult one.
Oh, can I give you two for two different reasons?
Yes.
One.
If someone wants to watch this interview, what is the one thing you want them to take away from the interview about you and about what you do?
Ooh, I love how we're getting straight into it.
Dive right in.
Always be open. That's one thing in my life that just literally has taken me literally all over the world. Being open with relationships, people, interactions, time, you know, have some constraints, but like be open. And then, that's just it in general. And then I would say, don't take life too seriously.
Yeah. I remember, so first year of law school, I realized it wasn't for me. Huh. If I was your lawyer.
Smart man.
I was like, if I'm your lawyer, you're going to jail. So I pivoted into tech, right? But obviously you went through all of it and, you know, did the bar. What was that moment for you when you knew law and specifically entertainment law was what you wanted to do?
That's an excellent question. And by the way, it turned out very well for you. So I would say, see, that goes back to don't take life too seriously, right?
For real, I'm saying
that because I had to take my own advice. There was a time, so back into what you say, law school, right? You go to law school, a lot of type A personalities. You see how you're not in.
Listen.
Like you try to tell people you literally have like tics sometimes because environments will trigger you to remind you, like law school, I might get myself in trouble, but we're having an honest conversation here. It's a very toxic environment. Am I lying?
You're not lying
it's
at
very
all.
Very toxic. So I didn't know. I don't have any lawyers in my family. I didn't have any reference point. So I'm going in. I'm the youngest of five kids. I was always told, hey, look, you're a little bossy. You have to gun your way through things, four girls, one boy. But one thing in all truthfulness, I'm an advocate. Like I love advocacy. And I thought for me, it's like, hey, that's people use this phrase a lot, but a seat at the table. I'm a child at this point. I don't know. People just say you push back, you're bold, you argue a lot. Lawyer, just the characteristics they hear. But when I got older and started to hone it, then I was like, yeah, I want to do this. Interesting fact about me, a lot of people don't know. I was a dancer. I was a trained dancer for 16 years of my life. So I'm a creative. So I didn't just stumble into entertainment. I didn't know how I was going to get there, but I have the mind of a creative, which there's the passion, right? Like the passion comes in, like you all wake up. I know you love your God-given gift, but you have to monetize it. So that's a direct calling for me. So law school, I feel like was a vehicle to like help and advocate for the group of people I want to, which are my creatives, as I call them.
Yeah.
And I want to dive deeper real quick because I was a dancer too. I was a dancer and I was a competitive cheerleader.
Amazing.
So I love this. So what did you train in? And I know with dancing, sometimes it feels like it has a shelf life.
Yes.
So did you feel like, oh, like, okay, I've gone as far as I can get to, but I need to bow out.
I'm talking to my people.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
It is, because what one thing people would do is discredit like dancers and cheerleaders. I'm like, no, you're athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I was a tomboy when I grew up. So I played it all, like, well, football, we'll call it football. You know, in the U.S. is soccer, but we did football, softball, track. I did all those sports, but dance is the one thing I kept to, but people would always, I would never hear them refer to that as me as being an athlete at that point. But I love, it speaks to discipline. Mm-hmm. I trained in modern. I did African. That's just sort of in our, it's in our DNA. But I didn't go and train in. I only did ballet for technique. So some people were a ballerina, you know, properly take, like modern dance was my jam, right? I just love the fusion of even the sounds and music that are chosen. So my fork in the road, I was 18. I literally was going to do the dance thing. If I had it my way, I would have gone to Alvin Ailey. Like I had this planned out. I wanted to dance for Ailey. You know how rigorous that was, but girls got a dream. I wanted to do Ailey, but I applied for 2 dance programs. I would never forget. And I didn't get in at 18 and it crushed my world. I remember the first few years I was in college. I remember, you know, I'm always a person who's happy for others, but I saw a couple of my friends who went on to college to be dance majors, went to live the dream, traveled the world, shelf life, back to your question, 3 to 5 years they did that. But you know, there's something you have to do when you're really young. So I remember being like, that could have been my life, but God's will is your life, right? So that didn't happen. At 18, I wasn't so like, I can handle it now, right? But I was like, why can't this happen? But honestly, I honed that in to say, I have to work with creatives. I didn't know. I mean, I'm not going to know how. But then that advocacy and law kicked in. Because again, I grew up to Nigerian parents who, we know there could be some pressure sometimes. They weren't. They were just like, 2 things you're going to do in my house. You're going to church. You're going to believe in God. And yep. I have my own personal relationship, yeah. But as a child, you're yeah. like, and then you're going to school.
Just nothing. And you're getting about. Straight A's.
And you're getting straight A's. And we're all Igbo, so like it's a thing.
Yeah.
But other than that, they didn't say profession. So they were amazing. So I already grew up in an environment of openness. As much as there's structure, parents, they're the parents, clearly, we're the children, but you can color in the lines. But I always tell this story. My parents, specifically my mom, was always like, leave that one alone. I colored outside a little bit. I was the child that was respectful enough. I respected authority, but I challenged some things sometimes. So that's where that advocacy kept showing up. But they couldn't say I was a bad student because we made great grades, right? And I would follow directions. But if I felt like there was an injustice, I'm going to pipe up.
Yeah.
So that's how I sort of merged it too. I was like, I got to do something with this or else I would feel like I'm going to implode. So that's what I find in advocacy is like, hey, how are you advocating for me? I'm on the side of talent. And I'm dealing with brands on the other side or a record label or whatever it is, a publisher saying, hey, I hear what you all are doing, but we got to protect the rights of the artist. So in dance, like I just use those transferable skills of discipline, honing in. And then now, I mean, I haven't danced in so long. I wish I would have. That's one thing I wish I would still keep up. But I feel like I get my fix off the clients I work with every day.
And speaking of that, you have managed multi-million dollar negotiations,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I want you to walk through what was the most difficult one.
Ooh.
Where it felt like we're not getting on the other side.
Oh, can I give you 2 for 2
yes.
different reasons?
Yes.
One, I'll start with the one that was more taxing and more positive. There was one you all always say, like, artist education advocacy. I can't say this enough because I get in trenches deeper than I probably should for artists, but that's the love. There was one newer artist, who I worked with, and I'll say some, but I won't say too much because if I say too much information, they're going to know who the person is. But he was a newer artist signed to a major label. And when we're saying major, you're talking Universal, Sony, Warner. And he was signed to, I could say this part, Interscope. And, a production company had taken him to that label. And what happens with those is you sign a deal with the production company and then the production company signs a deal with the label. Usually that's what happens. They did a first EP. It just didn't go the way they wanted it to. You all, labels have so much money that they wrote off the money. And we're talking, to give you all an idea, $250,000, $300,000, because they're dealing in the billions. And the production company wouldn't let him out. The label was like, we went back and forth maybe 2 months for a negotiation like that. That's not bad. The production company, do you know how long I was in that negotiation? 18 months. You see how both of you are your faces? 18 months. That's to date the longest negotiation I've ever been in my career.
I want to dive into that because yeah. We actually have a music distribution deal through Empire.
Okay. Very familiar.
And I love the Empire model yes. because it was just a straightforward mm-hmm. 80-20 split. Mm-hmm. You know what type of time you're on, mm-hmm. right? And one thing I've noticed about the entertainment space, there's a lot of scarcity when it comes to negotiations. Mm-hmm. What was the reasoning behind the production company wanting to even hold on to the person for 18 months?
Ego.
Ego, okay.
See how quickly I answered.
Yeah, very quickly.
Because there was, I remember being in the midst of it, just to show that you have power over somebody. That's what I took from it.
Yeah.
Because it can get dirty. And this is a cautionary tale to people. Please, please, please interview the people you are going to business with. Yeah. Please.
What was the second story?
Second story is a good one. One of the podcast deals I did. It took about, not 18 months, took about 4 months. But the clients were really happy. And but they were also willing to do something that at the time a major network wasn't used to in our community, as the Black community. They held off and they were willing to walk away. Mm-hmm. And when they saw that they were serious, they were like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like they didn't get everything. I manage expectations for every client. I said, yeah. Hey, we may not walk away with 100%, but if you feel like you got closer to the finish line than we were before, that could be 90%, 87% for somebody, we're good. So that's good when you feel appreciated and valued. Not that you do it for that, but when you have a client that realizes how hard you go for them, that's good. But also, I was empowered. We hear it a lot, but I've been blessed. I've seen a couple of clients at this point walk away from some lucrative deals. That's power. That's real power. People say power, but when you walk away from money knowing that, okay, if this is presented before me, it's just a matter of time, the next one will be there. So those kinds of deals are always gratifying to me.
Yeah. And another question I have around, even just because you talked about being careful and interviewing mm-hmm. someone before you go into business, what's the number one mistake you believe creatives and artists make yeah. when it comes to protecting their business, specifically their IP?
Oh, leading with desperation. People can feel it. It's palpable, right? Mm-hmm. Like we all get it. It's scrappy. Like I like to tell this disclaimer. I was broke when I started my own law practice because everybody's like, go to big law. I didn't feel like that's the way God called me. Like, we have to be so convicted. I moved to Atlanta. I was like, I just feel like I need to start over. And that's when I said the openness. I'm not saying it was easy. I like to tell this gritty part of my story because sometimes people think they may see whatever. But I'm like, I lived with my sister for the first 2 years. It's nothing like having the support of your family back to having a supportive family. What if my parents and my family were the ones like, what are you doing? They would have been like, you have a law degree, go to, but I was like, I don't feel like, not that, here's a disclaimer, if I ever do big law, which I don't really think I would, just know that it made sense. But other than that, culturally and the way my spirit ticks, I need to be able to do things like we're doing now, move around the world, meet people that energize me. And you generally speaking, as a traditional attorney, cannot do that. And I knew I was a very non-traditional attorney. So a lot of it was like, I would always tell, whether it's artists I'm working with, anything, like, know your value. And it shows up, y'all. Let me tell you how it shows up. I'll be negotiating. The minute an attorney steps in, client ceases communication with the label, brand, other artists, whoever it is. When they are texting, which they don't listen to us, when they are to other sides texting and they keep communicating and they're having conversations, they know they got you already. Because they know that the rule is lawyers talk to lawyers once they're in deals. But that's how they know they can get you. And then soon it'll be like, oh, I don't listen to your lawyer. She's slowing it down. This happens all the time. And then, so that's a lot of it, knowing the value.
And I want to talk about, because you mentioned this quite often, so I think it's important to highlight this part of your story. So you're Nigerian American, yes, right? Yes, very proud. Yes, we're proud Nigerian Americans. So my question is around you. I've seen you for years navigate between Africa and America. What does that look like? Yeah. And is there distinct things you see as far as law, right? Even negotiation, contracts that you think is different between the two?
Oh, I love that question, Chica. I would say a lot of it is the desire and passion we have. So I'm saying this not to jab at anybody, but people like us here on this couch, we started coming before it was a fad. We were coming into the market because we were born or live abroad, but we're taking that as a duty to come back home. So that's first. Intention is always important to me. When we sit and talk to people for 5 minutes, you're like, oh, and nothing's wrong with making money, by the way. But like, you're just here just for that. It's very transactional. So I just say, like, a lot of it is, that's such a great question you asked me. Like, what's the battery in my back, basically, right? Like, Chica keeps going back to advocacy. People keep like BSing us. And I was watching it from America and I'm like, what is happening? And like, am I being like gaslit? Like, I'm watching them give a fourth of the money in deals or leaving money on it. And I'm like, seriously, nobody's saying anything? at first you come, you can't come like that entitled American that people think, and you come and I'm gonna shake things up. I came and just tested the market the first few times. But then I saw there was a need, and it was music publishing. So I first co-founded a music publishing company here almost 9 years ago. Went my separate ways with the people, but even learning Naija business. Hey, it's another. So I had to close my eyes. I had to close my eyes for that one.
That's a whole another other topic.
Another day. But a lot of it, we could say it's tongue in cheek now. Yeah. It may have not been so fun or sexy then, but it's necessary. Mm. And I knew that. I knew that a big part of my legacy I want to be back here is that people like us, that we see each other literally, we've seen each other all over the world like us, but like we always end up back home. Yeah. And that was important, especially not growing up home. Mm. Being born and raised in America, my parents did a phenomenal job of making my siblings and I proud to be home. So I said in my adult life, again, one thing I'm open, I didn't know how it was going to happen, just started coming back. That was 10 years ago. So, yeah.
I want to touch more on the music publishing. Yeah. I don't know if you know, but Chica's first venture, one of the first ventures was music.
And lyrics. Yeah. I can just to give a little context to his question. So, and it goes back to this. I actually stopped because of a legal issue,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So, you know, the company Genius, yes. Right? Mm-hmm. So lyrics. I was creating that here in Nigeria. This was, 2011, a long time ago, right? Yeah. And I actually had to go directly to the artist to get their lyrics because it was nowhere online. Wow. And then I realized, I put a code in, this was my early technique. So I put a code within the lyrics. So I knew if someone was stealing the lyrics or lifting the lyrics and putting it on their website. And I noticed so many people were stealing from me. And then when I went to figure out what is the body that could protect me, I realized there was no protection. So I had to stop the business because I was like, there's no legal protection for
me. Can I ask you what that felt like when you knew that you were sitting on something that could be like revolutionary? I know people use that word a lot, but it really could like ripple. Like, what did that feel
I
like?
I was very sad.
Yeah.
Especially because we spent a stupid amount of money on the website.
Yeah.
The logo, everything was dope.
Yeah.
And essentially we had to just like put it to the side. I mean, I think everything happened for a reason, but now going to your question.
No, but the reason why I wanted to even bring that up is whether it's in entertainment or in music, there are so many businesses in Africa or in Nigeria where someone from maybe the diaspora will say, well, Genius is a company. This is how they monetize. If I go create the Genius of Africa, I should be able to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Stripe is a company.
Yep.
If I go create the Stripe for Africa, it should be the same thing. ADP Payroll is a company. If I go create the ADP for Africa, it should be the same thing. But for so many reasons, when they come over here, either there's not enough disposable income in the market or there's not enough regulatory bodies to help enforce some of these roles, or just plain, you're the first person doing it. And then when you stumble into it, there's a joke we always make as founders, you have this idea and you say, oh, how come no one's doing this? And then when you rush into the field, you see all the dead bodies of all the people who tried.
I love that.
You know, so I think my question more on the music publishing side is, because we were talking earlier about Koson and a bunch of these bodies.
Yeah.
What are some of the efforts that have translated even with struggling to do the music publishing? What have some of the things that might have changed since then? Because this was 9 years ago.
Yes. So I would say, again, we said we're having honest talk here. So I'm going to be honest because of accountability. We need that. Some things have changed, but not as quickly as they should have. So we are still dealing with some issues, but I'm saying this in real time, prayerfully, knowing that this will change within the next year or two by God's grace. But it's been something where like it's affecting the songwriters at the end of the day, you all. Because the way I like to explain publishers is a publisher is basically the music or the record label for the songwriter. Because who makes sure that the songwriter's paid? It's the publisher. So somebody who's a music producer or songwriter is out here not getting their money if you don't have a CMO or collection society that will collect on their behalf and pay them. Right. So these fundamental infrastructural issues, people throw a lot of words around infrastructure. How many times do we hear that? But like, that is what we're saying. But what about accountability that goes before infrastructure? What about saying like, and not in a finger point away, like, oh, because, and then the thing, and I want to get you all this experience. We come here and people think we're never coming with a savior complex, but we're treated like that at this time. So like, I'm not saying because I'm from America, everything's right by God knows we have some things we got to work on in that country. Every country does. But we're saying that let us in the conversation, because I promise you there are things we've been exposed to that you haven't. So that's it. First having that conversation. But I found 9 and 10 years ago, Chike and Eche, people were not open to it. They just weren't, especially coming from a woman. We're being real here.
Yeah.
Like, we have to be honest. Like, there is some resistance. Like, who is she? She hasn't been back home. Or she comes home in her adult life and thinks. And it's like, no, I'm telling you all, in these rooms where these majors, like, you are commodities used loosely in some sense, but like, they don't care about you. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
Let's be very clear about that.
I think the other thing there too is there's so many nuances involved in this, right? So you have maybe ASCAP and like a lot of these other institutions that were created to help, you know, collect some of these funds or the money that's coming in. But so many people also complain about how the music industry is structured even abroad, right? Yeah. And what we have in Africa is a chance to actually build something much more equitable, much more structured. So you would think that, hey guys, since we don't even necessarily have the structure yet, why don't we show a model that the rest of the world can actually copy, right? So Empire's model was one that maybe started much more recently in modern music institutions. And it's something we can actually do in Nigeria or in Africa, right? Yeah. So I think I don't know if that's a statement or a question, but I think my thought process with that is when we enter these rooms, it's always scarcity. Like, I feel like I always see that scarcity in the deals. And you're saying, why don't we build something that allows us to play long-term games with long-term people, right? If we move from an abundance mindset, the pie can actually be bigger. It doesn't actually have to be limited. And when I think about some of these bodies in Nigeria, it's because it's always rent-seeking behavior, right? So it's like, look, if we just hold on to this little pie we have, we can just rent-seek. It's like, no, the pie can be 1,000 times bigger.
And then the irony is the more you share, the more you make. Because it's, when we talk about the population, again, we're going to be Nigerian focused. I know everybody's listening to this globally. They're going to be like, these three Nigerians. But you know, we're proud of our country. But I'm saying, I'm going to give the demographics here. We're over 220 million. People said a couple years ago, we're probably 225 million.
Yeah.
At this point, right? Lagos, 21 million or so.
They be having kids, man.
Clearly, right? So market share wise, I often tell people in America, and I'm not breaking it down like you all would as founders, but at a high level, said you don't even need 1% of the market share. When I say that to people, they probably need 0.01 because of the numbers here. And it just almost makes them lose their breath. It's like when you hone in on your craft, the problem is people get here and want to do everything sometimes. And there's a time and place for that. But if you come in like you all have come in and you're like, here's the need we need to, here's the problem we need to fix it. And you literally need that same 0.01% of a market of 225 million people. We can do the numbers.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's what, if people just focus on that. But the problem is, I will find, I'm curious to get other industries. I could talk about the one I'm in, music. Even let me segue, because I represent y'all. We know a lot of mutual people. I'm sure they won't mind me saying. So even just watching talent grow and getting them before. So Earn Your Leisure is a client of mine. Y'all know that. We're friends. I worked with them before they took off.
Yeah.
So people see whatever is now, but I saw something about them because we were having conversations. I met them during COVID. So we were having our conversations on the phone, and it's because I came on their radar from a prior client that I had, and I was on a panel. We all love education here, talking about intellectual property in Atlanta. Somebody was there, and you never know. They're like, oh, these folks are up and coming. And I love with most of my clients that I hadn't followed them or watched anything. I like to vibe with them individually because you're going to work very closely with these people. So I don't care what you do, what kind of influence, if I think you're a jerk or our personalities aren't going to gel or you're not kind to people, it won't be a good fit.
Yeah.
That's the power in having your own practice, right? We choose each other, but I remember seeing it's about impact. I would hear how passionate they were. They were going to their high school in Greenberg, New York, to teach financial literacy specifically to the Black community before cameras were on. They took their iPhone. People know the story now and recorded, but they were doing it before anybody was watching. That's what gets me.
Yeah.
What are you doing when nobody's watching? That's where your heart is. And I just remember being like, I fool with y'all. Like, I just like you as people. And then literally, as I tell the story, I tell people maybe 6 to 9 months later, everything really just went through the stratosphere.
Yeah. And actually, this is a good thing I want to kind of hone in on. So as a lawyer, what what value do you think you bring to a client like Earn Your Leisure? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people don't talk about this because there's another creator and she talks a lot about how her life changed because a lawyer she brought in, right? Yeah. So I really want you to go into showing the value so more people can understand the importance of a lawyer relationship.
Thank you for that, Chica. Because a lot of times we lead from behind, which I have no problem doing that, right? I would say the easiest way I like to say is we protect the fort. If you're doing your job at that level, it's like specifically we know how the entertainment industry is, or you watch people go from like, you know, three owners of Earn Your Leisure. So Troy was a school teacher. Rashad was a financial advisor. And then there's Michael. He's behind the scenes. He's marketing. But they're all behind the scenes guys. Nobody knew about them. This is important for me to say that, Chico, because their lives changed when things took off. They went from like, they can't have a proper conversation or eat now. Yeah. I'm in Kenya, Rwanda. Like people know about these clients. It's strange still. I'm not surprised. It's just strange. So imagine shifting that. They come from a small town in New York, 45 minutes north of New York City. So just that was their environment. But a lot of it is just like managing, keeping them human. Yeah. I think that's the best part that I do. Like, y'all, we've all been together, like, in all in the same environments and rooms. Y'all, some we've all had conversations with regular people. That's how I treat all the clients that I deal with. I'm not, you know, we all put on our pants and outfits the same way. Yeah. That's one thing I try to keep every client, like, let's keep the human side of it. Like, we work closely together. So I think that's the biggest part, just keeping some level of normalcy, I guess, because their lives aren't normal as much anymore. But just doing that and protecting the fort, because there are a lot of hanger-ons and people that are pitching and protecting energy. Yeah. I spend more time protecting energy and deals. By the time something makes it in my inbox, it's something they're ready to do. Because even having a fort, they have a COO, which is like my little brother, Abdul. So I always mention him. He's like, but having the right people to like state the team. So by the time it makes them, oh, they're ready to activate because they've gotten rid of the noise, but they always show up as kind people. But a lot of it, Chica, most of it's a noise. It's a lot of noise when there's notoriety. It's just a lot. It's a lot of fanfare that I promise you, by God's grace, people star will shine as bright as they want. But when it's done, because there's always a time, those phones will stop ringing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the thing I wanted to even dive in with that is, I told you about my transition in law school, but the analogy I gave when I was explaining to my parents why law might not be for me anymore was you have a car that's being driven. You have the driver and you have a passenger. I said to them, the lawyer is like someone who's on the passenger seat telling the driver, slow down, make a left, make a right. Don't go over that cliff. And they're trying to make sure that in a little bit of way, you're a little bit more conservative from a lawyer perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, I told them I want to be the driver. I just realized that I loved being the driver. Yeah. I like driving off the cliff. Yes, that's what entrepreneurship is, right? And it requires a different sort of mindset. The reason why I'm bringing that up is you recently launched a platform, right? I believe it's Creative Passport.
Yes, yes.
That might mean you're also stepping into your entrepreneurship bag, right? So how do you deal with the tension between both? Because lawyers sometimes are a little bit much more risk averse versus entrepreneurship that requires you to take on more risk. So how have you balanced
the two? I love that question. Yeah. I would say, Jay, first of all, what you said is so important, and identifying that so early on in your life was vital. Because I always felt like that was the example I gave to Chica. I colored outside the line. So I felt like I had that entrepreneurship bug. But like my parents had an African food shop. That's important to say because I saw entrepreneurship.
Yeah, in practice.
I was born and raised in Raleigh, North Carolina. My mom is very picky till this day with food. But they started an African food shop because my dad wanted my mom to eat. Right? Like he came to America, simply put. You know, it's out of necessity.
Yeah.
He wanted her to eat, so they would ship food from back home. So I'm saying this to say I saw it, and I would help package food in the store. But if you're not around it consistently and you don't think it's in your lifeline, then you sort of dead that noise.
Yeah.
So I'm a non-traditional attorney, but still I'm like, oh, I always say I want to start a business. But nobody teaches entrepreneurship, you all. Law school. Definitely doesn't.
Definitely not.
Right? Like they teach you how to, I would argue law school doesn't even teach you how to be a lawyer. What it gives you are some phenomenal skills, problem solving. Like you're an active listener.
Triaging.
Triaging. What? You can listen to somebody talk for an hour and in 2 minutes tell them everything. that is a skill you can take anywhere. That's why lawyers go on to do policy and administration and various things, because you, the way you listen and reason are like very few. But it doesn't teach you how to be a lawyer. Like, it definitely doesn't teach you how to be an entrepreneur. But I always felt like, that's why I said the model I would buck the system of big law. That's where that was coming from. Never wanted to start my own law firm, but itching for that. Creative Passport came from like, hey, no more playing safe. Like, let's yeah. Go. Just because I have a whole bunch of people, and I have to say this because I don't want to feel like I was leaving the people I started with. But as you evolve, this is a real thing we need to say in our community. You can't always stay where you were. You have to grow. So in my client base, I realized I could no longer work with newer artists anymore because at this juncture in my career, not because I'm more important than them, I just don't have the time. I can't give the handholding that is needed to help develop a new artist. So that's what Creative Passport is. Serving as resources for people who are like, hey, I can't quite afford a lawyer. Not there yet. We don't have deals, but you still need knowledge. You need experience. So it's, you know, we'll probably have to talk about that offline. It's still a venture. I can learn quite a bit from others, but I know the passion and the heart is to reach those emerging creatives in emerging markets. That's how niche I am. I want it to be, I love that things are in America, but like focused in Nigeria. And like, I got to give this example. I've been to Saudi Arabia twice to speak about the Nigerian music industry. And I think that's very important to say because they see the value in it sometimes when we don't see the value.
Yeah.
They didn't ask me as an American attorney to speak about America because people seen the different models, but they know Nigeria's up next and is here. Mm-hmm. So again, when you niche down, so I'm like, there's something to it, but now it's figuring out how to scale. So I'm talking to two founders that we'll talk offline. I
mean, like, as soon as we started talking about Creative Passport, I'm like, there's an AI aspect to it, but we'll talk. We'll
but definitely, that's y'all strength. You see how your brain
on
like,
we'll take all talk offline because I already went. I was
like, keep me as the visionary. But that's what I'm learning to your point. Yeah. I had to learn my leadership style. Yeah. As a lawyer, I could be granular because I'm offering that service. I get it. It's professional services. But as a leader, keep me at the visionary.
Yeah.
I just learned it like a year ago.
Yeah.
But it took me much longer than you two. I'm sure you knew it instantly. I'm like, when people pull me into the weeds, creativity's gone. I'm like, keep me up here, please, so I can dream because God's going to give the visions. He's going to open the doors. He's going to build the relationships. But like, I need the vision. And when people start to get with all the operations, I'm like, okay, idea's gone.
One of the questions I have, well, it's a two-part question. Mm-hmm. So number one, I'm curious what is happening in Saudi Arabia, okay, that there's interest in the Nigerian music market. Mm-hmm. But number two, what I'm seeing is a globalization, yes, right, of Nigerian, Ghanaian, mm-hmm, South African, Kenyan artists. I'm curious what are the steps or the challenges of them expanding beyond the African market?
I love it. First in Saudi, I have to go back to go forward. Music was, I may be a year or two off, was just legalized in the country about 8 years ago. Yeah. Mm. See, it made me, like when I spent time there, I was like, so they have been, you know, their resources were, they're an oil rich nation and they'd focused on that. But as they started opening their borders to the world because of globalization, they're still a more conservative society, but just beautiful culture. But they realize music is a moneymaker and they have a story to tell through music. You know, music is ubiquitous. Like, they're going to share it in a way that we are not from the Middle East. We're not from Saudi. Mm. Their sound, like, it's rich. So they wanted to start letting the world know, Chica. And that started about 6 years ago or so. So guess what they're looking at? The current state. And who's killing it right now?
Nigerians.
Yeah, Nigeria. Come on, people. They don't have to look too far. This is why I'm talking about our value. So I've told you in 2 years, well, now we're in 2025. So 2022 was the first year I was invited. And then 2024, I was invited. Both times. Because they want to talk about Nigeria. And Nigeria was a country of focus for it was the XP Music Conference. So you're seeing that they're coming up. They're starting that. And the difference is they have such a wealth of resources. And their government backs them. Imagine where Nigeria could be.
Yeah.
I'm watching this from the time I went. It was 2 years difference. I saw a change. You all, when you see it like that, where we could go is endless. We just need, I guess this is a call to action. I didn't know I was going to do this, but we really need our back. We need private sector assistance and we need our government to really champion this for real. There was so much money. So to answer your question, Saudi had the money, resources, they're ready to show their music to the world. But guess what they don't have? I don't care how much money you have. They don't have infrastructure. They don't know how to run entertainment. Not because they didn't. They were in a bubble for several years. Yeah. So guess what? They're going to look to the world's leaders. And undeniably so, sound-wise, Nigeria is one of them. Yeah. We got to work on our infrastructure here, though.
What would you say is the one piece of advice you'd have for an upcoming artist? Like, what are some of the repeatable mistakes that you make, that they make, where you're like, look, if there was one piece of advice I could give an upcoming artist, this is what it would be.
Not understanding the crux of how they make money. Let's deal with music. Copyright. Don't give away the very thing that makes you money. If you give away your copyright, well, here's a disclaimer. If you sign a major deal, that is the trade-off. They want, people hear the word masters. That's what it is. It's giving up. There are two parts of a record, a sound recording and a music composition. You're giving up the sound recording portion. That's a trade-off. But if you all even watch, there are fewer major label deals. You're talking empires, independent or indies, as people will say. Indie deals are licensing terms, and the licensing terms could run its gamut. It's a term. But it is giving away copyright, not knowing the terminology in their respective place. You don't have to study it, but know what work for hire is. Understand that if you sign this, then you get paid $2,500 or you get paid $10,000. That's it.
That's it.
There is no recourse on the back end. There is nothing. That's it. So somebody will sign it, be like, oh, my record is top 20 in the charts. You know what kind of money they can make back end? You sign work for hire language. There's nothing to talk about short of somebody having a mental incapacity or them being under duress. As far as America goes, you're hard pressed getting out of a contract like that. So it's them not having a high level understanding of that podcast. How do you make money in podcasts? I'm not talking about the silos. You make money in podcasts through ad revenue sales. Understand the basic foundation of how money is made in your industry. That's all an artist needs to do. Your team does not need to learn that for you. You need to read a book, sit in a studio, pick the brains of mentors and know that part. Then have your team to help you enforce it around you. But your average artist is not willing to learn that.
You know, this is very interesting because we are focusing on entertainment law and music. But there was something I wanted to get your thoughts on, which I've tried to communicate this to some other founders or even to some legal folks. But I wanted to get your your thoughts on this. I went to law school. Yes. I understood and I went through the training, but then I pivoted to being an entrepreneur full time. And something that I noticed depending on the sort of training a person might have, if they've come from like maybe Big Four or a consultant, is they're so compliance heavy where it's like when they get into a startup, they're not able to make that transition.
They're not fluid.
Yeah. And I wanted to get your thoughts on something because so many times they would be like, hey, before we even launch this, let's go make sure we get all the compliance checks done. Let's do all these things. Whereas as a startup, the first thing you're supposed to do is make sure that you're actually a viable business.
Yes.
And trying to explain that to some folks, it's like the tension between, instead of worrying about all the legal stuff, make sure you're actually alive, first of all.
Absolutely.
Right? That's the whole point first. Like, is this an actual business? Yeah. Whereas I had an ex-co-founder and she was like, yo, let's go get all this compliance stuff. Let's go to all the countries. And I'm like, fam, is the business actually alive first?
Absolutely. You're going to spend all that money on all those resources and countries. Yes, you want it to reach there, but like, did you test the product in the market?
Yeah.
That's an entrepreneur talking. Yeah. Your founders, right? Yeah. So I found this interesting. I went to law school, but like, I've always thought, and again, remember, I didn't know, like, oh, entrepreneurship, the audacity of me thinking I could do that, right? Like, you know, I went there, but I always had the mind of somebody who was willing to take risk. So I'm not risk adverse like your average lawyer. Like, I'm like, let's figure it out. And I'm type B in real life. Like, like I said, we're all travelers. Yeah. Like, we float, like, we go like that. That's, and I think that's the part that has been the most interesting. I think people think I'm a lot more rigid than I am because of my title as a lawyer. And we're often prejudged for many things in life. But like, that's one big one I feel. And I feel it the older I get, or the people think I'm going to show up a different way. Then I'll lean in and be like, oh, you're a lot cooler than I thought. And I'm like, oh, you felt the need to tell me that? It was like, you're much nicer than the average lawyer. And I said, that speaks volumes about my profession. But honestly, and there was a time I did take myself seriously because I thought I had to follow certain things. But a lot of it is when you free yourself from all that BS, it's like, hey, I'm going to show up in the way that moves me. Yeah. But to your point, I would be the one in the room like, you're right, go test it in the market. I'll be the one that would be like, you're supposed to tell to protect. I'm like, hey, but I'm a business person too. Before you spend all this money, go try it here in this market. Like,
make sure it's viable.
Absolutely. Yeah. But lawyers, in the best way. Sorry, did I roll my eyes? I'm sorry.
And what's the biggest misconception of entertainment lawyers?
Oh, Chica, that's a great question. Can I break it up?
Yes.
I think in some instances that there would be an arrogance attached to it. And there's some, I can't blame some people. There's some people that feed off the air of their clients and it's sort of like, relax. Like, I'm just not that person as though. Like, chill. Like, you know, so I think that's it. And then as a Black woman, being an entertainment attorney, I get the passive aggressive. I don't get it as much anymore, but I used to get it. It's sort of like, hey, how did you start working with them? What are you insinuating? Do you ask my white counterpart that? Mm. And I know this is going everywhere. This is a fit. This is my life, so I can talk about it, right?
Speak your truth.
I know it's going to be triggering to people, but I have watched my counterpart, same age, same experience, whatever, white male counterpart. You're not asking him that question. What are you insinuating? Because I work with a whole bunch of Black men. What are you saying? Mm. You know? You get where I'm going?
Mm.
How do you start working with them? Then when you turn it back on, how do you start working with your clients? They're quiet. I know what you're doing. That's the kind of stuff we have to deal with as women. Like, I believed in them before you would. That's why they're here, because they know a Black woman will hold them down. Any other questions? Like, why are we here? And they don't like that too when you're slick a little bit. And then you smile about it. What do they call it? Nice, nasty, whatever.
Yeah.
It's not, but it's being honest. It's like, how dare you when you know I'm in a country and I got to work 10 times harder than you.
Yeah.
Even if that is somebody's truth, everybody live your life.
Yeah.
But to ask and insinuate a question as if, how did you get your person? How did you get yours? Yeah, like, and when you flip it, it's like, but again, that happened. And I think now a lot of it is, it's a vain culture we're in, but it is what it is. As your clients accelerate and excel by God's grace, you get those questions, you get it in a different way. It might be an older male counterpart, because I have to understand it's not personal sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are just in a generation where a Black woman wasn't their counterpart as a lawyer. It's a real thing. And I've learned to read the room. I've always read the room, but now it's like you were triggered as they call this baby attorney from 0 to 5. But I've been out of law school 15 years now. So it's like.
what would you then say is, because just piggybacking off that, you have operated in both the Nigerian and American entertainment industries. So what is the biggest cultural difference between the two and how business is done?
I would say accountability. Because in America, we all know if you violate the copyright law, somebody sends you a cease and desist and you choose to discredit, you're going to get sued and you're going to court. And if the federal judge grants them statutory damages, whatever it is, you got to pay. If they don't, there's a default judgment. Then they can start taking assets. Right? You see, there's a whole process I just walked through. Here, you see how we all laugh? It's like somebody violates. It's a... Well, yeah, let them listen to the music. And it's like, there's no consequence.
Yeah.
There has to be, you all, in any area of law, especially something where you want to monetize for people. There has to be accountability. There has to be this person saying, you cannot play this person's song if you don't have a license. Like, you just can't. It starts at a level. So I would say accountability, enforcement of the law. Those are the two big things.
So I want to throw some rapid fire questions at you, right? Mm-hmm. So number one, what is your go-to power outfit?
Oh, I like a good boo-boo like you have on now. I get my clothes made.
For closing a deal?
For closing a deal. Yeah. But the thing is, I get a lot of clothes made. So it might be a printed African pant
that's
made from Ankara or something here. And maybe a solid Black shirt, but I'm showing my culture in the bottom. But showing you like I could be whatever up top. So that's it.
Okay. And what's your most used emoji?
The crying emoji, because I'm laughing at somebody. I love that question.
And if you had to switch careers, what would it be?
I would be a sociologist.
Oh, explain. Y'all,
I'm so fascinated by human behavior. So fascinated. That would be one of the things. But I chose a gig where I get to assess people anyway. So, but I mean, I would be, I'm always asking you, can I get two? Because that's where my brain is. Yes. Like, it's like, I would be like you all. A founder of something, I would dare to give myself permission to do it at a younger age.
Yeah.
But as far as if I had to choose like a rigid career that people are saying, sociology by trade. Oh, I love to watch people. Mm.
And what's your favorite spot in Lagos? Whenever you come and you're like, I'm looking forward to. Yeah.
Oh, cilantro. I love cilantro.
Really?
I love cilantro. Oh, that's like one of my favorite restaurants. I was just there 2 days ago. I love other places I go. That's my restaurant. For whatever, the vibe, the food, the customer service, where it is to be, cilantro is my spot.
What's your one guilty pleasure TV show?
Oh my Gosh, when it used to be on Scandal.
Oh my God.
That show.
I'm watching it right now.
She's literally watching it right now.
It's on my iPad right now.
And if I can go back and watch it, that show, I don't care where I was. Like, I'm not fixed on a lot of TV these days, but that show, when that thing went off, you would have thought somebody took something from you when they decided to end the whole show. And I was like, what is it? Like, but Scandal's one of the best written shows I've ever seen in my life. Is that fair to say?
It is. It's so layered. And I'm funny enough, I'm actually now at the last season. I'm a little annoyed at the last season. I won't go too into it.
Yeah.
But I would say you literally see the evolution of Olivia Pope's character, like full circle. Absolutely. So,
God, I mean,
see, that's how good it is.
Let me ask you. So between Suits and Scandal.
I've never seen Suits.
Oh, no. Come on.
Do I need to go watch it?
No, you do. Because that's one of the reasons I went to law school. That's what I got bamboozled.
Are you judging me?
He's like, what's going on?
He's like, you're a lawyer.
I need to now watch.
I don't know. I knew Meghan Markle was on it.
No. You need to. It's funny enough. Meghan Markle, she has her little role. But the two of them. The two main characters.
Okay. So I gotta watch it. Just like you binge watch it. I have to, you all give me assignment. I have to watch
please,
it too.
Please,
yeah, you
please.
Have, you'll love it. Okay. Tell me how you feel about it.
I'll text you and let you know.
I wanted to, because we were having a conversation on Saturday.
Yes.
Around the changing dynamics in dating and relationships, right? I don't know. Did you have any thoughts? Because we didn't have a chance to dig into it.
I wanted to get to the good part.
But I think for context, we were talking about the changing dynamics in dating between men and women, how over maybe the last couple of years, the whole deal had been go to school, get a job, get married. Mm-hmm. It feels like a lot of Black women held up their end of the bargain.
Yes.
And now a lot more Black men are like, we're not doing the last part.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's so many conversations you have around this in your personal or professional life. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things you've observed as a sociologist?
Yes.
And what are some insights that you would like to share as well?
I would say, and I don't mind sharing my experience. So I'm single. And a lot of it is these are my personal views. I feel like, and even more narrowly, Black women in America, which is how we all started talking about different things, felt like they held their end of the bargain. And then it's like, hey, was I sold a pipe dream? Because it's like you were told to do all the things. Put your head down. Don't look at boys. Study. Don't depend on anybody. Blah, blah, blah. You look up and you're like, oh, I did all stuff I was supposed to do. And now you're telling me I can get this many people. And then they have this. Guys have so many options. Like, I'm in Atlanta. You see how that in your soul, it just came up. Right? Everybody's like, my city's a challenge, but the sheer ratio, they're like, I think I lost count. You all fact check behind me, but I'm pretty sure I've lived there for 13 years now. We're 14 to 1, 15 to 1.
Heterosexual men, black minimum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's important to say.
And you didn't count the DL.
Yeah. So it's like, it's in the mid-teens. Like, those numbers are staggering. So a lot of women feel like, hey, like, does it even matter if I go out? Like, I'm just being honest. Like, or it feels more challenging. And it feels like, I also came from an age and stage where the men courted. I'm sorry, all this stuff.
All this new age stuff.
All this texting to get to know. No, a man would call you, tell you, I want to take you on a date, tell you what time to show up, or say, can I pick you up? Like, I came from an age of that. I can't go back.
Yeah.
So the women that have that and everybody's own standards, we were even talking about, I'm triggered by high value, all that stuff.
High value, low value, high functioning. I don't even understand
it. Yeah. I don't even really get it. And I stay out of the conversation.
I can break it down though, okay, to make it easy. So, because I watched, I think it was the interview Cam Newton did with the lady.
Dr. Bryant.
Oh, I heard it was heated.
I loved that interview because I sent it to a lot of my male friends to just go watch, because for the first time I felt like she articulated specifically what the distinction was, right? Because a lot of men, going back to your point, most of the men now think they're the bad bitches, right? Yes. So it is just what it is.
Exactly. Especially in Atlanta.
You know it.
But the context there was, we were also conditioned to think, if we have the money, if you have the status, that's all you need as a man, right? And so that's what high value is. This is the value that you mean in society, right? the distinction though is you can be high value but low functioning. Low functioning, or you're just functioning in general, is your emotional intelligence. How do you show up, right? And so for a lot of the men, it's, hey, I substitute my functioning to the money and the status. So, but when they get into a marriage or into a relationship, they don't know how to function because they don't understand that the money and the status is not the only thing that a marriage or a family needs, right? So you also need emotional intelligence. So what you really low-key want to always optimize for is high functioning and even low value versus high value and low functioning. Because with high functioning, they can always increase their value. But if you don't work on your functioning, you can be high value and still be an idiot through the whole
process. I love that you said that distinction, but let me throw something out there. Because I know, like, we were having our conversation, but we always keep it real here. How do you feel that some men are functioning when women are operating at a higher level these days? It's different from when our parents came up, but our parents made those sacrifices so we can get to some of these places. But I feel like, just as somebody who's single in the market still, like, it's not digested well by every man. They'll show up to you all as other men and say, oh, I'm good. But it shows up in different ways to the woman. And I don't even like using insecurity, intimidation, those words that are overused. But I think it does show up differently.
Just not comfortable.
They're not comfortable. It's different. It looks different than what they're used to. The mother that raised them, the auntie that's around, this, like, it's just different. Like, how do you feel that some men are digesting it these days?
So I think I wrote an article maybe about 4 months ago speaking to this about how the modern man has to show up. And then I think it was modern masculinity and also strategic softness when it comes to women, right? And I think what happened is a lot has changed and men recognize that women do earn more. But what's happened is we've not gone back to, like, reset how we approach these things. So if I now know women earn more, or women, I might even meet a woman who earns more than me. What is now my value to her if I'm not the provider and I'm not necessarily the one spending all the money? I now need to shift to what's complementing her. So as a partner. So what does that look like? In the home, in career, I am your partner, right? I compliment you. I can shower you with praise. I can advise you. I can lead. Because leadership, again, doesn't always come down to what's in your pocket, right? So I think it's for the men to just understand that being a partner is now saying, look, if her inner wisdom is stronger than me in this arena, let her lead. If my inner wisdom is stronger in this arena, I will lead, right? But being able to shift between the two. So that's where the partnership back comes in. What happens though is with a lot of men, they don't even want to deal with that duality, right? So it's like, look, it's my way or the highway. Bro, this is not 1850, right? So it's really more about adapting, which is why I was saying the emotional intelligence comes into play, because if the men have done therapy, therapy allows them to be much more self-aware. It's the self-awareness that allows you to then have the emotional intelligence to say, this is, and this is how I should navigate this situation, right? So I think part of it is teaching men, or sharing with men, like, look, if you're going to show up as a modern day man in modern day marriage dynamics, your role is to compliment your wife or your partner, not necessarily to lord it over her. And so that's the distinction that has to.
I love, we hear the male perspective. I want to hear your perspective. What do you,
so we just had an episode and we talked about this and this is my number one thing. We talked about accountability. Men need to be held accountable. My biggest challenge, and I'm someone who is a creator and I create content on some of these topics, is I see way too many men telling women what to do. Way too many. I'm not seeing enough men talking directly to men. If you, especially you think about Atlanta, because I think some of these creators are based out of Atlanta. Some of the biggest conversations, like Hardly Initiated podcasts, right? Because they're, I believe they're based out of Atlanta. Steven Speaks, like some of these big creators and conversations are men talking to women.
That's a great point.
Where are the men talking to men? Where are the private conversations with men? So for me, you know, I try my best. Like when I speak to some of his male friends that are single and they're just telling me stories of why they're single. And I'm like, you need therapy. You need some coaching and you need to step up. But I'm a woman. There's only so much I can say. I think more men need to speak to men. I think when that starts to happen, then there's going to be a shift, because there's just, there's too many men that are single and they're just like waiting around and I don't know what's going on.
Like Etche said, they are just like, they ticked off the other stuff. Right. Yeah. And then got to that point. It was like, I got way too many options. And they just, there's just not any urgency. That's what I feel is where they're just, it's like, sort of like, oh, we could just hang in this place where nobody really knows. And limbo. If she doesn't ask, in limbo, she doesn't ask and I'll keep. And it's like, what happened to leadership? Because like you said, leadership shows up in different ways. It's not all about, and everybody, when you choose your partners, that's why I even say, like I said, interview. If I'm saying interview for a team member, this is your life partner. Y'all are married. Y'all cool. Yeah. You know, I haven't been married yet, but like, I've been around enough people in my life to know that like getting married now, like there's certain questions you ask. I need a partner, not in that the way people throw it away, in a way that's like, hey, I have these really big, scary visions and dreams I want to share. Can I share it with you without you resenting me for thinking that big? That's been a concern, if I'm being honest with me. It's like, do you have a word? Do you have a, I want to hear your take.
So I have another layer here too. Yeah. Because we can speak about the men, and Eche is doing his part to hold more men accountable. And I think more men need to do it. But ladies, our standards have dropped. A lot of our standards have dropped. No, no, it's true. Now, I from what you're saying, I don't get the vibe that it's your situation. Yeah. But no, there's but too many. Honest, yeah, but there's too many women. Like when I speak to women, I'll never forget. There was a woman I was spoken to. And she was like, there was a new guy she was dating. And she's like, but I can't get over the other guy. And when she started explaining to me this other guy, I'm like, wait a minute. So you were with him for like 1 month. You weren't in a relationship with him. Why does he have a chokehold on you? You know, like it didn't really add up and make sense. And I have these conversations all the time. So I also feel like somewhere along the line, I don't know if it's desperation. I don't know what it is. The standards have dropped. So now men are like, oh yeah, like there is a woman out there that would take me as I am. Look at Cam Newton. Yes. How many? Yeah. I mean, he has what? Three, four baby mama.
Like eight kids.
So clearly.
Yeah. No. No. Agreed. Yeah. So when I leaned in and say, being honest, like, yeah, because this is a dialogue we need to have.
Yeah.
People like us, I can, that's why I can confidently say, because I don't feel like being single is a death sentence.
No.
It's all in the way you digest it. Like God has allowed me to see and do some things that I just never thought I'll do. But because I'm not married doesn't make me less than.
Yeah.
I think it's the way you digest it too, right? Mm. So can I take accountability for there are times I should have put more energy? That is a thing. Because if we talked a few years ago, you might be like, oof. Like energy-wise, not bad, but I just was...
You were in a different place.
I was in a different place. Yeah. But I understand that like God created us for companionship, but also being safe. Safety is very important. We can't say this to men enough. We tell them all the time. I don't care, which I know we were texting about this. I don't care what a woman does. I don't care what God allows her to accomplish. She always wants to feel security and safety from whoever her partner is with. I don't care if she's the CEO of Google. It doesn't matter. You need to feel like that's your person, that he chooses you every time, that you feel safe there, that you can dream your biggest dreams, that you could be your most vulnerable.